Maplewood Barn Radio Theater, brought to you in conjunction with KBIA Radio. Today's show is an adaptation of a short play by Floyd Dell entitled Sweet and Twenty. It was first produced by the Provincetown Players, New York City, in 1918, with a young Edna St. Vincent playing the leading female role. The play was dedicated to her. When it was first performed, Dell and St. Vincent were probably in the midst of their brief but passionate love affair, but more on that later. Sweet and Twenty takes place in the corner of a cherry orchard, on the country estate of the late Mr. Bogley, which is on sale and open for inspection to prospective buyers. The cherry orchard, now in full bloom, is a very pleasant place. There is a green-painted rustic bench beside the path. An attractive lady sits on the bench among the blossoms. A handsome young man strolling through the orchard stumbles upon her.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Oh, you needn't. I have no right to be here either.
Now, what do you mean by that?
I thought perhaps you were playing truant, as I am.
Playing truant?
I was looking at the house, you know, and I got tired and ran away.
Well, to tell the truth, so did I. It's dull work, isn't it?
We have looked at so many houses the last few days, and here I've been upstairs and down for 2 hours. That family portrait gallery finished me. It was so old and gloomy and dead that I felt as if I were dead myself. I just had to do something. I wanted to jab my parasol through the window pane. I understand just how the suffragettes felt, but I was afraid of shocking the real estate agent. He's such a meek little man, and he seemed to think so well of me. If I had broken the window, I would have shattered his ideals of womanhood, I'm afraid. So I just slipped away quietly and came here.
May I sit down?
Of course.
I've only been there half an hour, and I've only been in the basement. That's why we didn't meet earlier, I suppose. I've been busy cross-examining the furnace. Do you understand furnaces? I don't.
Do you like family portraits? I hate them.
What? Do the family portraits go with the house?
No, thank heaven. They've been bequeathed to some museum, so I heard. They're valuable historically, early colonial governors and all that sort of stuff. But there is someone with me who takes a deep interest in such things.
Didn't I see you at that real estate office in New York yesterday?
Yes, he was with me then.
I thought I remembered seeing you with him.
Isn't he just the sort of man who would be interested in family portraits?
Well, since you ask me...
Oh, that's all right. Tubby's a dear, in spite of his funny old ideas. I like him very much.
Yes.
He's so anxious to please me in buying this house. I suppose it's all right to have a house, but I'd like to become acquainted with it gradually. I'd like to feel that there's always some corner left to explore, some mystery saved up for a rainy day. Tubby can't understand that. He drags me everywhere, explaining how we'll keep this and change that. Dormer windows here and perhaps a new wing there. I suppose you've been rebuilding the house in your mind, too?
Not really. I've only decided to turn that sunny south room into a study. It would make a very pleasant place to work. But if you really want the place, I'd hate to take it away from you.
I was just going to say that if you really wanted it, I'd withdraw. It was Tubby's idea to buy it, you know, not mine. You do want it, don't you?
I can't say that I do. It's so infernally big. But Maria thinks I ought to have it. Maria is...
She's the one who is interested in furnaces. I understand. I saw her with you at the real estate office yesterday. Well, furnaces are necessary, I suppose. Do you see that bee?
A bee?
Yes, there. The rascal. There he goes. Have you heard the story of the people who used to live here?
No, why?
The agent was telling us. It's quite romantic and rather sad. You see, the man that built this house was in love with a girl. He was building it for her as a surprise, but he had neglected to mention that he was in love with her. And so, in pique, she married another man, though she was really in love with him. The news came just when he had finished the house. He shut it up for a year or two, but eventually married someone else, and they lived here for 10 years, most unhappily. Then they went abroad, and the house was sold. It was bought, curiously enough, by the husband of the girl he had been in love with. They lived here till they died hating each other to the end, the agent says.
It gives me the shivers. To think of that house, haunted by the memories of wasted love. Which of us, I wonder, will have to live in it? I don't want to.
Oh, don't take it so seriously as all that. If one can't live in a house where there's been an unhappy marriage, why, good heavens, where is one going to live? Most marriages, I fancy, are unhappy.
A bitter philosophy for one so young and...
Nonsense. But listen to the rest of the story. The most interesting part is about this very orchard.
Really?
Yes, this orchard, it seems, was here before the house was. It was part of an old farm where he and she, the unhappy lovers, you know, stopped one day while they were out driving and asked for something to eat. The farmer's wife was busy, but she gave them each a glass of milk and told them they could eat all the cherries they wanted. So they picked a hatful of cherries and ate them, sitting on the bench like this one. And then he fell in love with her.
And didn't tell her so?
So you see, this orchard is haunted too.
I feel it. I seem to hear the ghost of that old-time lover whispering to me.
Indeed. What does he say?
He says, I was a coward. You must be bold. I was silent. You must speak out.
That's very curious, because that old lover isn't dead at all. He's a congressman or senator or something, the agent says.
It's all the same. His youth is dead, and it's his youth that speaks to me.
You mustn't believe everything that ghosts tell you.
Oh, but I must, for they know the folly of silence, the bitterness of cowardice.
The circumstances were slightly different, weren't they?
I don't care.
You know perfectly well it's no use.
I can't help that.
Please, you simply mustn't. It's disgraceful.
What's disgraceful?
What you are going to say.
Only that I love you. What is there disgraceful about that? It's beautiful.
It's wrong.
It's inevitable.
Why inevitable? Can't you talk with a girl in an orchard for half an hour without falling in love with her?
Not if the girl is you.
But why me, especially?
I don't know. Love is a mystery. I only know that I was destined to love you.
How can you be so sure?
Because you've changed the world for me. It's as though I've been groping about in the dark, and then sunrise. And there's a strange feeling here. To tell the honest truth, there's an even stranger feeling in the pit of my stomach. It's a feeling as if I'm dreaming, and my knees are weak. I now know why men used to fall on their knees when they told a girl they loved her. It was because they couldn't stand up. And there's a feeling in my feet as though I were walking on air. And...
That's enough.
And I could die for you and be glad of the chance. It's perfectly absurd, but it's absolutely true. I've never spoken to you before, and heaven knows I may never get a chance to speak to you again. But I'd never forgive myself if I didn't say this to you now. I love you. Love you. Love you. Now, tell me I'm a fool. Tell me to go. Anything. I've said my say. Why don't you speak?
I have nothing to say except that I, well... I feel some of those symptoms myself.
You love me.
I don't know. Yes, perhaps.
Then kiss me.
No.
Kiss me.
Oh, what's the use?
I don't know. I don't care. I only know that we love each other.
I don't care either. I do want to kiss you.
It is wrong.
Is it?
But, oh heaven, kiss me again.
Darling.
Do you suppose anyone is likely to come this way?
No.
Your husband is probably still in the portrait gallery.
My husband? What do you mean? You didn't think... You thought poor old Tubby was my husband.
Why, isn't he your husband?
No, he's my uncle.
Your uncle?
Yes, of course. Do you suppose I would be married to a man that's fat and bald and 40 years old?
I beg your pardon. I did think so.
Just because you saw me with him. How ridiculous.
It was a silly mistake. But the things you said, you spoke so realistically about marriage.
It was your marriage I was speaking about. Oh, I beg your...
My marriage? Good heavens. And to whom, pray, did you think I was married? To Maria. Why, Maria is my aunt.
Yes, of course. How stupid of me.
Let's get this straight. Are you married to anybody?
Certainly not. As if I would let myself be kissed like that if I were a married woman.
Now, don't put on airs. You did something quite as improper. You kissed a married man.
I didn't.
It's the same thing. You thought I was married.
But you aren't.
No, I'm not married. And you're not married. In fact...
Yes?
In fact, well, there's no reason in the world why we shouldn't fall in love with each other.
Why, that's so.
Then shall we?
Oh, not if you don't want to.
Well... Under the circumstances, I suppose I ought to begin by asking you to marry me.
You don't seem very anxious to.
It isn't that, but, well...
Well, what?
Dash it all, I don't know your name.
That didn't seem to stop you a while ago.
Well, then, will you marry me?
No.
No? Why do you say that?
Why should I marry you? I know nothing about you. I've known you for less than an hour.
That fact didn't seem to keep you from kissing me.
Besides, I don't like the way you go about it. If you'd propose in a proper way, maybe I'd accept you.
All right. I kneel before you. Beloved. No, I can't do it. I'm very sorry.
Perhaps it's because you don't love me anymore.
Of course I love you.
But you don't want to marry me. I see.
Not at all. I do want to marry you, but...
Well?
Marriage is a serious matter. Now, don't take offense. I only meant that, well, we are in love with each other, and that's the important thing. But as you said, we don't know each other. I've no doubt that when we get acquainted, we will like each other better still, but we've got to get acquainted first.
You're just like Tubby buying a house. You want to know all about it. Well, I warn you that you'll never know all about me, so you needn't try.
It was your suggestion.
Oh, all right. Go ahead and cross-examine me if you like. I'll tell you to begin with that I'm perfectly healthy and that there's no TB, insanity, or socialism in my family. What else do you want to know?
Why did you put in socialism along with insanity and TB?
Oh, just for fun. You aren't a socialist, are you?
Yes. Do you know what socialism is?
It's the same thing as anarchy, isn't it?
No, at least not my kind. I believe the government should be responsible for public transportation, schools, building roads, and all that sort of thing. I'll give you some books to read.
Well, I don't drive, so I don't care whether they build roads or not. By the way, do you dance?
No.
You must learn right away. I can't bother to teach you myself, but I know where you can get private lessons and become really good in a month. It is stupid not to be able to dance.
I can see myself doing the tango.
The tango went out long ago, my dear.
Well, I won't learn to dance. You might as well know that to begin with.
And I won't read your old books on socialism. You might as well know that to begin with.
Come, come. This will never do. You see, my dear, it's simply that I can't dance, and there's no use in me trying to learn.
Anybody can learn. I've made expert dancers out of the awkwardest men.
But you see, I've no inclination toward dancing. It's out of my world.
And I've no inclination toward governmental responsibility. It's out of my world.
It ought not to be out of the world of any intelligent person.
Ah, now you call me stupid.
It appears that we have very few tastes in common.
So it seems.
If we married, we might be happy for a month.
Perhaps.
And then the same old story. Quarrels.
I never could bear quarrels.
An unhappy marriage.
Oh.
I can't marry you.
Nobody asked you to, sir.
Well, there seems to be no more to say.
Except goodbye.
Well, madam, goodbye then.
At least give me your hand, sir. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Oh, take me in your arms.
Oh, damn it all, we do love each other.
What a pity that is the only thing we have in common.
Do you suppose that is enough?
I wish it were.
A month of happiness?
Yes.
And then a lifetime of wretchedness?
No, never.
We mustn't do it.
I suppose not.
Come, let us control ourselves.
Yes, let's.
Come, let's at least part friends. I wish you happiness. I'll go to Europe for a year. Try to forget me.
I shall be married when you get back. Perhaps.
I hope it's somebody that's not bald and fat and 40. Otherwise...
And you, for goodness sake. Marry a girl that's very young and very, very pretty. That will help.
Look, we mustn't prolong this. If we stay together another minute...
Then go.
I can't go.
You must, darling, you must.
Oh, if somebody would only come along.
Ah, who is that?
Excuse me.
The agent.
I am so sorry. Too late. Too late.
No, just in time.
Too late, I say. I will leave you alone.
No, stay.
What's the use? It has already begun. What good can I do now?
I'll show you what good you can do now. Come here. Yes, that's it. Now, can you unloose my hands from those of this young woman?
You needn't bother. I can do it myself.
Thank you. It was utterly beyond my power. Dear sir, will you kindly take hold of me and move me over there? Thank you. At this distance, I can perhaps say farewell in a seemly and innocuous manner.
Young man, you will not say farewell to that young lady for at least 10 days, and perhaps never.
What?
They have arranged it all.
Who have arranged what?
Your aunt, Miss Brooke. And, young lady, your uncle, Mr. Edgerton.
Edgerton? Are you Helen Edgerton?
And are you George Brooke?
Your aunt and uncle have just discovered each other up at the house, and they have arranged for you all to take dinner together tonight, and then go to a 10-day house party at Mr. Edgerton's place on Long Island. The reason for all this will be plain to you. They want you two to get married. You know, married, hitched, wedded, joined together in a sanctified union of holy bliss.
Yes, yes, we get the point. Good heavens. Helen, we're done for. We'll have to get married now, whether we want to or not.
What? Just to please them? I won't do it.
You don't know my Aunt Maria.
And Tubby will try to bully me, I suppose. But I won't do it, no matter what he says.
Pardon what may seem an impertinence, miss, but is it really true that you don't want to marry this young man?
I suppose because you saw me in his arms. Oh, I want to, all right, but...
Then what seems to be the trouble?
Oh, you explain it to him, George.
Well, you see, it's this way. As you may have deduced from what you saw, we are madly in love with each other.
But I'm not madly in love with governmental responsibility. That's the chief difficulty.
No, the chief difficulty is that I refuse to entertain even a platonic affection for the tango.
I told you the tango had gone out long ago.
Well, then the polka.
Stupid.
And there you have it. No doubt it seems ridiculous to you.
Not at all, my boy. I've known marriage to crumble on far less than that. When you come to think of it, a taste for dancing and a taste for governmental responsibility stand at the two ends of the earth away from each other. They represent two different ways of taking life. And if two people, who live in the same house, can't agree on those two things, they disagree on 100 things that came up every day. And what's the use of two different kinds of beings to try to live together? It doesn't work, no matter how much love there is between them.
Then you're on our side. You'll help us not get married.
Your aunt is very set on it. And your uncle, too, miss.
We must find some way to get out of it, or they'll have us cooped up together in that house before we know it. Is there anything you can do to help us? Can you think of a scheme?
Perhaps I can, and perhaps I can't. I'm a bachelor myself, miss. And that means I've thought up many a scheme to get out of marriage myself.
You scoundrel!
Oh, it's not as bad as you might think, miss. I've always gone through the marriage ceremony to please them, but that's not what I call marriage.
Then what do you call marriage?
Yes, I'd like to know.
Marriage, my young friends, is an iniquitous arrangement devised by the devil himself for driving all the love out of the hearts of lovers. They start out as much in love with each other as you two are today, and they end by being as sick of the sight of each other as you two will be 5 years hence, if I don't find a way of saving you from marriage, the devil's own trap. It's not lack of love that's the problem with marriage. It's marriage itself. And when I say marriage, I don't mean promising to love, honor, and obey, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health until death do you part. That's only human nature to want to and to strive for. And it might be done if it weren't for the iniquitous arrangement of marriage.
But what is the iniquitous arrangement?
Ah, that's the trouble. If I tell you, you won't believe me. You'll go ahead and try it out and find out what all the unhappy ones have found out before you. Listen to me, my children. Did you ever go on a picnic? Of course you have. Everyone has. There is an instinct in us which makes us go back to the ways of our savage ancestors, to gather about a fire in the forest, to cook meat on a pointed stick, and to eat it with our fingers. But how many books would you write, young man, if you had to go back to the campfire every day for your lunch? And how many new dances would you invent if you lived eternally in the picnic stage of civilization? No, the picnic is incompatible with everyday living, as incompatible as marriage.
But
marriage is the nest-building instinct turned by the devil himself into an institution to hold the human soul in chains. The whole story of marriage is told in the old riddle. Why do their birds in their nests agree? Because if they don't, they'll fall out. That's it. Marriage is a nest so small that there is no room in it for disagreement. Now, it may be all right for birds to agree, but human beings are not built that way. They disagree and home becomes a little hell. Or else they do agree, at the expense of the soul's freedom stifled in one or both.
Yes, but tell me...
Shh! Yet there is the nest-building instinct. You feel it, both of you. If you don't now, you will as soon as you are married. If you are fools, you will try to live all your lives in a love nest, and you will imprison your souls within it, and the devil himself will laugh.
George, I am beginning to be afraid of him.
So am I.
If you are wise, you will build yourself a little nest secretly in the woods away from civilization, and you will run away together to that nest whenever you are in the mood. A nest so small that it will only hold two beings and one thought, the thought of love. And then you will come back refreshed to civilization, where every soul is different from every other soul. You will let each other alone, forget each other, and do your own work in peace. Do you understand?
He means we should occupy separate sides of the house, I think. Or else that we should live apart and only see each other on weekends. I'm not sure which.
I mean that you should not stifle love with civilization, nor encumber civilization with love. What have they to do with each other? You think you want a fellow student of economics. You are wrong. You think you want a dancing partner. You are mistaken. You want a revelation of the glory of the universe.
It's blithering nonsense, of course. But it was something like that, just a bit ago.
Yes, when we knew it was our first kiss and thought it was to be our last.
A kiss is always the first kiss, and the last, or it is nothing.
He's quite mad.
Absolutely.
Mad? Of course I'm mad, but...
Ah, here you are. Thought you'd given us the slip, did you? Sorry about this, folks. He escaped from the asylum, he did, a week ago. We've been hunting him, high and low. Come along now.
What's the matter with him?
Matter with him? He went crazy, he did, reading the works of Bernard Shaw. And if he wasn't in the insane asylum, he'd be in jail. He's a bigamist, he is. He married 14 women, but none of them would go to the witness stand against him. Said he was an ideal husband, they did. 14 of them. But otherwise, he's perfectly harmless.
Perfectly harmless. Yes, perfectly harmless.
Come on.
Goodbye now. Goodbye. Good luck, you beautiful young couple.
Well, that explains it all.
Yes. And yet I feel there was something in what he was saying.
Well, are we going to get married or not? We've got to decide that before we face my uncle and your aunt.
Of course we'll get married. You have your work and I mine, and...
Well, if we do, then you can't have that sunny south room for a study. I want it for a nursery.
The nursery?
Yes, babies, you know.
But how... Good heavens.
Okay, that's the end of the show, Darren. Okay. Narration right there. How are we on time?
And such is the convoluted course of young love, reflecting Floyd Dell and Edna St. Vincent Millay's own romance. In 1916, Floyd Dell was a well-known figure on New York's Greenwich Village scene. He was generally considered a 29-year-old ladies' man, having one fling after another. At age 24, Edna St. Vincent Millay was a new arrival in Greenwich Village. She was soon cast in one of Dell's plays. He found her very appealing, with a mouth like a valentine. Millay joined the Provincetown Theater Group, where a shack at the end of a fisherman's wharf had been turned into a theater. Others who wrote or acted for the group included Eugene O'Neill, John Reed, Susan Glaspell, and Louise Bryant. Millay was considered a great success as Annabelle in Floyd Dell's The Angel Intrudes. After a few years, Dell and Millay became lovers. Just as she could skillfully interpret the lines in Dell's plays, he was able to see the subtext in her poetry and identify emotional undertones no one had ever noticed before. Initially, Millay was amazed at Dell's insight, but she soon began to find it invasive. "There are doors in my mind that you must not try to open," she admonished. While Millay seemed at ease with Dell's reputation for philandering and agreed that they were both flirty and fickle, Dell hoped that Millay might settle down. Being a few years older and with many affairs behind him, Dell was starting to feel the urge to start a family. Millay, however, was attracted to both men and women. She had been wary of involvements with men before Dell, but their relationship seemed to give her confidence to have lovers of both sexes. Towards the end of their affair, Dell was distracted by more serious matters like World War I and a possible jail sentence for taking part in the publication of The Masses, which the U.S. government considered seditious literature. Edna gave Floyd a farewell dinner before he went to boot camp and welcomed him back after his honorable discharge. But soon after, when Dell, Millay, and the radical writer John Reed the subject of Warren Beatty's film Reds, spent an evening together riding the Staten Island ferry, Dell decided that their romance would never come to fruition. He resolved to move on. Millay seemed to be constantly falling in love with someone new, and her spirit would always belong to the world at large, and never to just one man. In his autobiography, Dell wrote of her, "Edna St. Vincent Millay was a person of such many-sided charm that to know her was to have a tremendous enrichment of one's life and new horizons. Edna Millay was to become the lover's poet, but with some of her poems she was also to give dignity and sweetness to those passionate friendships between girls and adolescents, where they stand terrified at the bogeys which haunt the realm of grown-up man and woman love, and turn back for a while to linger in the enchanted garden of childhood. She had a gift for friendship. People try to draw a distinction between friendship and love, but friendship had for her all the candor and fearlessness of love, as love had for her the gaiety and generosity of friendship." Following their breakup, Millay and Dell were finally able to marry and commit to others who suited them better. They never reconnected romantically, though Dell was deeply saddened by news of Millay's death in 1950. While Dell never achieved the fame of Edna St. Vincent Millay, he still seemed integral to her artistic development as an early love that would lead to many others and to the expansion of her poetic soul. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Floyd Dell's one-act play, Sweet and Twenty. Our players were Beth Krause as Helen, Harrison Plummer as George, Joe Bogue as the agent, and Ben Buchanan as the guard. Our producer was Darren Helwidge, and this is your narrator, Brad Buchanan. Please join us next week for another Maplewood Barn radio production of stories by classic authors. Thank you. And good night.